I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit corin.com.
This week on a special Valentine's Day edition of Meat & Three, we put a twist on the lovey-dovey holiday.
The mission statement is save the world through silliness and chocolate, and in parentheses, launch a chocolate bar into outer space. But I'm having some conflict on the board members with the parentheses. That's okay.
He cited that in his area there used to be 30 dairy farms and now there are 3.
You know, dessert was political, and what you had on the dessert table said more about you than other markers of success.
Tune in to Meat & Three, HRN's weekly food news and storytelling roundup wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi umami in izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is a mystery for many people, so I try to demystify this program with my cool guests. My guests today are Alexis Ariano Sanborn and Chris Whitaker. Alexis joined me on episode 106 in January 2018 to discuss the production of her new film, Nourishing Japan. She is the producer and the director of the film, and now it is finally on view. Chris is a professional composer, conductor, and a pianist, and he created beautiful songs for the film. And he is also Alexis' husband. And the new film, Nourishing Japan, introduces us to the unique Japanese food education philosophy through an example of the school lunch program at an elementary school in the Tohoku region. And healthy eating has become an important subject globally in recent years. And the Japanese government enacted new legislation for food education, or what's called shokuiku, in 2005 to improve Japanese people's diet and lifestyle of all ages. The film inspires us to think what food education can do to our healthy mind, body, and beyond. So today we'll discuss the philosophy of Japanese food education, how the Japanese school lunch programs differ from those in the US and other countries, what children actually can learn through the programs, who supports the system to function well, and much, much more. But quickly before we start, Japan Eats is available on Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. And I have a quick announcement. So if you listened to the show last week, but I have to repeat because I wrote a book about Japanese food. And it recently came out in Japan in December, but now it's available worldwide on Amazon website. It is called A Complete Guide to Japanese Cuisine, and the Japanese title is 英語でガイド、外国人が一番食べたい和食90選. There are two titles because it's written in both English and Japanese side by side. The book is kind of mini encyclopedia of Japanese food, and it covers 90 dishes, sweets, and beverages with fun facts along with the foundational philosophy and history of Japanese cuisine. You can bring the book with you on your trip to Japan or to your favorite Japanese restaurant in your town as a guidebook. And if you work at a Japanese restaurant, it can be your go-to reference. Also, if you grew up in Japan and the book is useful to explain the basics of Japanese food accurately to non-Japanese people. Or it can be a fun textbook for both English and Japanese language learners. Again, it's available in bookstores in Japan and some bookstores outside of Japan, such as Kinokuniya and Amazon Worldwide from Amazon website. And so the Again, the title is A Complete Guide to Japanese Cuisine, and in Japanese, 英語でガイド、外国人が一番食べたい和食給食店。I hope you enjoy reading it. So finally now, let's start a conversation with Alexis Ariano Sanborn and Chris Whitaker. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
So I was so looking forward to this final, the completion of the film since you came to the show. So congratulations.
Thank you so much. Well, I feel like I've been talking with you about it, or, you know, I've visited here on the show to talk about it, and now it feels, being back in the studio, like coming full circle.
Yeah, I'm sure it was kind of emotional, right, when you're done, so.
Yeah, it was an emotional journey, and just being able to talk to you about it and seeing people's reaction of the film was great.
Mm, okay, so we'll talk about that too. So first of all, for listeners who don't know anything about you guys, so Alexis first, where are you from? What your relationship with Japan, and how do you get to making a film about Japanese colleges?
Sure. So I'm originally from California, and I'm an East Coast transplant now, here, living here. And I've been studying Japanese food and Japanese culture and history since I was a teenager, actually. And I'd been to Japan many times before and had experienced Japanese food many different ways, through host families, living on my own. But it was always kind of eating food, or choosing the foods that I wanted to eat on my terms. And it wasn't until I was an English teacher living in rural Shimane Prefecture that I really had an opportunity to engage with types of food that I might not normally eat, and that was through school lunch. And it really captured my interest, and it's been something that I've been continuing to study in depth for close to a decade now.
Right. So for listeners, if you're curious about how Alexis, who didn't like Japanese food at all, conquered all the challenges, now became a professional.
That's right.
Yeah.
She was converted.
Right. Okay. So Chris, where are you from? How did you get into music? And what do you do in the world of music?
Yes. So I'm originally from South Central Pennsylvania, but I've been in New York City for about the last 7.5 years. And my connection to Japanese food and this film comes through my lovely wife, Alexis. But I've been a composer since a young age. I started writing little songs at the piano when I was 6 or 7 years old.
Wow.
And just that continued my musical journey. And now I work as a music director at a church. I do a lot of freelance composition, and I run a chamber orchestra in Upper Manhattan called the Washington Heights Chamber Orchestra. So I've done a couple of film projects in the last couple of years, but this one was a particularly special one that I got to score Alexis's documentary, right? Nourishing Japan.
That was your first documentary, right?
My first documentary,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Wow. Yeah, I really think usually I just overlook all those background music, but this one was really elevating the experience. I got some goosebumps.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, so thank you so much for the music. All right, and then you got married last year?
That's right, last June.
Oh, yeah. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How did you guys meet?
Well, we actually met online. And we met on OkCupid.
It's a little old school at this point.
Yeah.
OkCupid.
Yeah. I was somebody who does I think NPR does a, you know, Valentine's Day interview thing. And then OkCupid, very hard that you can be rejected.
We were lucky.
Yeah. You know, there's actually a funny story that's tangentially related to the film, though, because we were just back at the Japanese ambassador's residence for a special screening of the film.
Mm.
And it turns out that the very first picture I ever saw of Alexis on OkCupid was of her at the Japanese ambassador's residence.
Oh, wow.
And so it was kind of has this funny connection to our story. We took a picture in the exact spot where I first, the photo
first
that I first saw
from
years ago. So it was an interesting little sidebar.
Right.
It's connected to the film and the story of our relationship.
Mm, that's kind of destiny, right? Lovely.
I like to think so.
Right. Okay, so let's talk about the new exciting film, Nourishing Japan. So it's about 25 minutes or so, and there's a lot of inspiration in it. So first, what's the theme of the film, and why did you decide to make it?
So I think there's lots of different themes to the film, but what it all kind of boils down to, I think, is that food is something that we should cherish. And the various aspects that food comes into our life, through the people that we connect with, through the communities that help to create food, to even just our experience of consuming food. And the idea was that I wanted to show how community and public policy could really work together through food to improve the lives of so many people, not mm-hmm. just children, but across all of society.
Mm, right. So, yeah, I think, you know, many, many podcasts discuss it's food, but it's more about lifestyle. And I think it's going to be becoming more of not just something goes into your mouth.
Yeah.
Yeah, how you live.
Yeah, and just kind of how you you interact with the world around you, the natural world around you. That was something I really wanted to bring into the film, mm. was not just food, but the sense of the environment and place.
Right. It's funny, we don't think of food coming out of farms, but it's more about from supermarkets.
Mm.
So that's so how stupid is it, right? Just forget about it.
Well, we're just, you know, in our everyday lives, we're not really, you know, we're not working on the farm. A lot of us, we're not growing our own food. So it's very easy to forget.
Right.
And I wanted to kind of remind viewers of the path that food takes.
Right. Okay, so the film is not just about specific Japanese food education policy or anything. It's about what we should do about food with food.
Yeah, I think food education, shokuiku, is one sort of facet of that and one that I really wanted to explore through the film. But I think what shokuiku is trying to do is bring food and our relationship to food and a positive relationship to food more to the forefront of our conversation, more to the forefront of our mind. And the Japanese government did this through policy, but... Mm. But it's not something that you necessarily need a policy to if community and society can come together in a grassroots kind of way.
Right. So shoku is food and iku is grow. So it's not growing plants or anything, but it's more of a grow with food.
Yeah.
As a human being, kind of idea. Right. And so in 2005, the Japanese government enacted a new food education law. And that was a big deal. So do you know why they just did it, like, in 2005, not before? Or?
Well, I think that there were probably a lot of issues that the government was trying to approach or solve. And they were issues that are not necessarily unique to Japan. Obesity was rising in Japan very slowly, but it was increasing. The diet was changing. There was more... processed fatty foods, an increase in meat consumption. The local agricultural sector, you know, could certainly use the support.
Mm-hmm.
And food education was also trying to encourage people to think about, you know, eating meals regularly, having a healthy diet, and making sure that what was going into your body was balanced and nutritional. And so it was really, I think, trying to tackle these issues and more to kind of confront some of the trends that were emerging in Japan at that time. And it was kind of a preventative kind of law.
Right. Yeah, and actually we went to the original law, and it was really plainly, nicely written. I could understand. And so that's basically, like you said, like obesity to, like, you know, skipping meals and unbalanced nutrition intake and also lifestyle diseases like we all suffer from in the States too. And also, I think they stress they're really afraid of losing a local traditional food culture.
Yes, that's right.
Right. So, and also the goal of new law is to provide individual, this is like a rough translation, but the law is to provide individuals of all ages in Japan with knowledge and capability to make proper judgment on healthy diet and lifestyle. So it's beyond just what to, you know, you eat on today's table, but you have to have human knowledge and capacity.
Yeah, and shokuiku, when people might see the film, they might think that it's something that is only enacted in schools for the younger generation, but really it's something that encompasses the entire society.
Mm.
And you can find in retirement homes, there are classes on shokuiku, or shokuiku is discussed, or in local restaurants and communities, they have local initiatives to try to make things healthier, more vegetables in certain menu items. And so it kind of trickles or comes to the surface across a variety of ways.
Right. And also the law has some articles about, you know, it's not just teachers at school. And local governments are asked to be involved, and the farmers. And it's really, like, everybody
It's really grassroots, and volunteerism. People who are passionate about it are encouraged to be involved, whether you're a farmer or a daycare worker, or just, you know, staying, you know, a stay-at-home mother.
Right. And so the other aspect of this, I think this law is really great. And so they created new teachers specialized in food and nutrition. So that's, I think, a big deal, a new job at schools.
Yeah, it helped to create this new type of job that I like to think of it kind of, they're titled as nutrition coordinator, or it can be translated that way. But it's really serving as a way to be both a nutritionist and a teacher. And in the context of the film, the individual who we saw really serves as a voice of the schools to the school lunch center, and the school lunch center to the schools, so that they can kind of learn about how certain meals are going. And then within a more formal context, the nutrition coordinators, they have a variety of classes. They work across a variety of schools to teach children about what a healthy meal looks like, or what are, for example, three food groups, or even like what are the traditional types of crops that are grown in the region, or what's the traditional food? Because a lot of children, you know, may not have the opportunity to experience those traditional flavors anymore as they're kind of dying out.
Right. Everything is packaged in plastic.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So those teachers, when they teach and how often they teach?
So it's really dependent on the local community, the local school, and government. From my research, I've been able to find that teachers usually have a class with one grade once a semester, perhaps twice a semester. And then other types, they coordinate with the other teachers at the school to try to integrate other types of learnings into the other subjects that the students are learning. So once or twice a semester, they might have a formal food education class, but then other components are tied in collaboration with some of the other homeroom teachers or math teachers or what have you.
Right. And so what kind of subjects do they teach to kids?
Well, it depends on the grade level. The nutrition coordinator who we saw in the film, she was teaching a class of second graders, and she was teaching them very basic things like, you know, when you look at a plate, when you look at a tray or at a meal, you know, what are the different components, to be able to identify meats and vegetables and grains or carbohydrates. As children progress in years, some of the attention is then turned to, like, who are the different people involved in the labor force? And even at a very young age, children are beginning to understand what a farmer does, who are the people that are involved in making the school lunch meals, what is kind of the labor that is involved. And that was something that was also included in the law as well, is kind of an awareness of the people who are involved.
Right. So literally from farm to table, who's involved?
Yeah.
And that kind of, you understand, doesn't come by way from factory or anything.
Yeah.
It's more of a connection between whoever.
One of my favorite parts about the scene in that second grade classroom is when the teacher is explaining to the students that this food becomes your body. It becomes flesh and bones. And I think that that's something that seems so simple, but is actually quite profound for these children to understand from a young age, that what you are putting into your body is literally becoming your body.
That's true, right? It's just, once you look at, have that awareness, it's scary to what you choose.
Yeah. Makes you look at a bag of chips differently.
Right. Yeah, and I think another thing of, you know, the school lunch program, I mean, we're going to discuss it in a moment, but you are not choosing.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah.
You are told to eat anything because it's good for you. And you learn through challenges. Yes. And when I was in Japan, I grew up, I hated certain things, but you learn, and it's acquired taste. Eventually, you're able to
eat. Yeah, I mean, I had that same experience as a 22-year-old.
Right. So, okay. And so, for our listeners who are not familiar with how Japanese school lunch works, could you describe what happens at lunchtime? Because, you know, the nutrition teachers teach in classroom style, but then you practice at lunchtime. Mm. Right.
Yeah, so school lunch in Japan, well, it happens every day. Mm. And the meals are either usually created on the school itself or in a school lunch center. And the children are involved in picking up the meals that are kind of dropped off in a certain delivery spot. And these meals have to meet certain nutritional guidelines that are set forth by the government and are created fresh from scratch, and are delivered hopefully as hot as possible. Mm-hmm. And the students then are involved in picking up the trays and bringing them to their classroom. And that starts as early as first grade. Mm-hmm. And it is with help and guidance from other teachers that the students learn, you know, how to transport things and how to serve the meals themselves. It's something that, you know, takes years of kind of learning and repetition to be able to kind of, for it to become comfortable and just kind of every day. But it's very participatory, and the children know their responsibility because the meals themselves, once they are in the room, they are distributed by the children themselves.
Right. So the classroom, like, you know, like 12 o'clock, kids would move
the
table.
Desk. That's right.
And they make the table, right? Communal.
And there's table. No, I mean, typically there's no cafeteria in Japanese school. So that's a really big difference. Lunchtime is kind of seen as an extension of class time. It's not a sort of a free time where everyone can go a little crazy. It's still, mm-hmm. You know, maybe recess might be for that, but it's still a part of you are in class.
Right.
And the students move the tables, usually into groups, and they all have, you know, trays that are washed every day. It's very green if you look at it from that way, very sustainable because they use trays and bowls that are washed. And the students distribute the meals. There's usually kind of an assembly line.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, so you divide, like, you know, you take turn, right? Like every month, like for a week, you're in charge of serving.
That's right.
And I feel like this kid, I serve extra, that kind of how things happen too. But
well, it's really takes a lot of hand-eye coordination, I think, because you only get a certain amount of food per class, and you have to make sure that, you know, you distribute out that food enough.
Right.
So that everyone gets an equal amount.
Right.
And sometimes
and
that
no
might
leftover
take,
ideally.
And ideally no leftover.
Right.
Yeah.
So
then the food is distributed and everyone has to wait until all the everyone has been served and everyone is at their seats kind of waiting sort of at attention. And the meal begins when the classroom leaders say itadakimasu, which is can be translated to like I humbly partake, or it's a sign to begin the meal. And so then students can sit down or are sitting down and enjoy the meal. And while they are eating, oftentimes in elementary school, there's a kind of radio broadcast that's done by the students. And that is also an incredible resource to be able to learn about, for the children to be able to learn about, okay, what am I eating today? Because this type of information is announced on this broadcast. So like, oh, these potatoes are from Farmer Yamada down the road or something like that.
Mm. And the nutritional values, like, and, you know, calories and vitamin A and whatever.
Or like included in this soup is wakame, and this is a great source of this vitamin. And so, you know, maybe they don't, you know that they're learning or know that they are absorbing this information, but when you hear this, you know, years after years, you can begin to kind of absorb nutritional knowledge, even in kind of a casual type of way and not a formal classroom setting.
Right. And by the way, it was my first radio experience when I announced one of those.
Oh, really? You were one of those classrooms? Yeah. Oh, that's great.
Well, everybody takes turns.
Yeah.
Yeah, everybody, wow, the microphone. This is my first time. And it's like a whole different experience.
Yeah.
Because you say it and you understand what you're saying. It's about nutrition of food. And it's like very, like you said, very participatory experience. Yeah. And also I think, you know, the social setting and teachers eating as well, so they observed, then you know how to behave when you eat with other people.
Yeah, the teachers are still there in the classroom making sure that, you know, everyone's attending to eating and that the attention is focused on eating your meal in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a time where, you know, the goal is to kind of finish the meal. And certainly some kids might struggle with certain things and they might try their best to finish the meals if they have ingredients that they might not like or something like that.
Right.
But the teachers are there to support the children during that time.
Right. And also I think it's important to know that they don't pick people to eat with.
Yes. There's no sort of cafeteria clique or anything like that.
Right. So it's like you just, you know, to move around the desks and make a table of people whoever happened to be in the same group.
And it relieves just such burden, you know, because I remember when I was a kid eating in the cafeteria, like, who are you going to sit with? You can't be alone. It can be very, you know, stressful on a young child. And so to know that decision is taken out of your hands, I think, also makes you feel in a better frame of mind to be eating your meal in front of you.
Right. So it's a very social experience too. So, so you feature an elementary school in Yamagata Prefecture, the northeast western part of mainland Japan. So it's Yamagata-ken, Tsuruokashi. So why did you choose the school in this specific region?
So Tsuruokashi is actually the birthplace of school lunch in Japan. And I had known this for years in doing my research and my master's thesis. And I knew that when I wanted to try to get to Tsuruoka, to go to this temple and to film there and to interview the temple keeper. And in the course of reaching out to Tsuruoka City and the Board of Education, we began to have a conversation about, well, would it be possible to film in other locations? And I really wanted to try to keep the storytelling to as few locations as possible. And it just so happens that in addition to being the birthplace of school lunch, Tsuruoka is also a UNESCO gastronomic creative city. So they have a very strong food culture, a very deep pride of their food culture. And they also happen to have several schools that had wonderful facilities for creating school lunches. And so I think there was this pride and openness and desire to want to share the good things that were happening in Tsuruoka.
Mm-hmm.
And so this school that we ended up filming in, I didn't know what to expect. We had been, during the pre-production, we had been filming in different parts of Japan. This was my first time to come to Tsuruoka and to be with the school and the students. And it was just a very warm kind of organic development of a relationship there.
Right. Yeah, so listeners, if you see the film, it's really amazing how all those people captured in the film is very forward-minded, very ethical and warm, and just good people.
Yeah.
I was really moved by them.
I really wanted to, I think the people that we interviewed, they were wonderful, ethical people, as you say, really warm. But I also think that those types of people exist in every community, and I wanted to kind of show, the kind of universal nature of their jobs, their work, their belief in what they were doing on an everyday level through Tsuruoka as a city.
Mm. Right. Okay, so let's take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll discuss the key messages from Nourishing Japan. So please stay with us. Today's program is brought to you by Corin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Corin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan Asian to American, and that is why they are located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Corin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Corin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit corin.com. Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guests today are Alexis Aliano Sanborn and Chris Whitaker. Alexis is the producer and director of the new film, Nourishing Japan, and Chris composed beautiful songs for the film. So one thing I wanted to talk about was the world of farmers.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think about that?
Well, they were great. they all had, interviewing them all, they all kind of had their own sort of way that they approached food and food production, and their own kind of story of what they wanted to share through the food. One of the farmers, I refer to him as the cabbage farmer. Mm-hmm. He was really about cherishing kind of local crops and heritage crops that had been grown in the region. And that was one of the things that we talked a lot about. Whereas others were, people who, they had grown, their father had grown up with farming, but then... And they hadn't necessarily embraced it at first, but then through experience, they had come to understand and realize the joy in the work. Mm. And they were everyone who I talked to. I talked to several other farmers who didn't, unfortunately, end up making it in the film because there were so many farmers to talk to. Because everyone was so enthusiastic and believed about the importance of having fresh produce in schools.
Right. Yeah, I think the farmer you just mentioned, so he succeeded the business from the father, and the father said, go meet people.
Yeah.
And then he realized, because I'm making vegetables for people, now suddenly the motivation is different.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not from growing vegetables to make people
making
happier.
People happy, exactly.
Yeah. So and then so the farmers eat with kids, right?
Yeah, some of them do. They go and they visit schools, and they talk to children about their work. The farmer we were just mentioning, he said he really liked to talk a lot to the students about building the importance of good soil. And whenever he went and talked to students, he always wanted to talk to them about the importance of, you can't grow, good vegetables. You can't grow something delicious if you don't have good soil.
Right.
And so he really talked about the message of farming from the ground up.
Mm.
And you could tell that he was really inspired talking to the next generation.
I'm sure if you hear from farmers directly, you see food differently.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. He would talk about how he would grow potatoes and they would go and eat them in class and just, I think kids oftentimes, didn't make that connection that these people that they saw out in the fields, what were they doing?
Mm.
What was this food that they were growing and where was it going? And
right.
To be able to have that connection, I think, has inspired a lot of children.
Right. So let's now play some music by Chris. So and you can tell us what it is. So,
sure.
Yeah. So first of all, it's the song is School Lunch Center Scene. And cool engineer Matt is going to play.
So this scene is when we visit the school lunch center where the meals for the region are prepared. And what I was trying to capture is kind of the kinetic energy of the place, that you've got all of these cooks cooking vegetables in large vats and chopping up ingredients, you know, just boxes and boxes of carrots and celery and other vegetables. My hope with this film, first of all, you think a documentary about school lunch, how emotionally compelling could this possibly be? But when you see the film, I think that you'll be delighted to see that there's a really amazing emotional arc to the film that ties it together. And something I was thinking about as we were talking earlier was that the involvement of these farmers and cooks and principals in the Japanese school lunch system, it doesn't just affect the students. It actually has a profound effect on the adults and changing the way that they see food. And I think that that's something we get over the course of the film as well. And so writing music for the film was actually quite a joyful experience, because I got to kind of hook into this this rather emotional narrative, a surprising emotional narrative that kind of runs throughout the whole thing.
Mm.
And so this scene was in particular to kind of capture the fun almost mechanization of the school lunch center, kind of drawing from some perhaps minimalist influences and repeated piano chords and marimba and that kind of thing.
Right. And all those big figures you see in the film, that's of devoted cooks every single day, you know, thinking of it's good for the kids. And it's really, I think their roles are very important, and as the film captured it very well.
Yeah.
So, and the next one is On the Farm. So Matt, thank you.
So one of the decisions that we had to make in scoring this film was, did we want what kind of sound did we want it to have, and did we want there to be something in the music that was quote Japanese? And we basically decided against that for me as an American trying to inhabit a sound world that I don't really live and breathe in was going to come across as inauthentic. So this scene of being down on the farm, I use pizzicato strings and guitar, and there's even the sort of American folk instrument called the dobro, which kind of has this kind of sound that feels a little bit down home and very kind of country. And so for, you know, an American audience that's watching this scene of a Japanese farm, you know, there's a kind of fun familiarity while drawing this kind of subtly from a folk sensibility that might not feel foreign to a Japanese listener as well. The one requirement that Alexis had for me as I was scoring the film was that she wanted me to use recorders, actually. And you can hear a little bit of that in the first clip that you played, because the sound of the recorder in elementary school is this kind of omnipresent this omnipresent soundtrack of fifth graders playing recorders. And so it was a sweet kind of nod to the elementary school soundscape that we wanted to make sure we included to capture the spirit of the subject.
Right. Yeah, I really like that song. All right, so next one is Back at the School, Temple, Playground.
So one of the things that I tried to do in approaching the scoring of this film was that each scene has its own character. Each scene kind of embodies the outlook of the people that we're watching. And so the dialogue before this scene, this is in the film, what's going on is the kids are finishing class for the day. The teacher says, okay, the lesson is done. And so everyone starts to transform the classroom into their kitchen and eat a meal together. And right before this, we hear from the gentleman who actually created the 2005 legislation, and he's talking about the importance of all the children being treated equally. And so one of the things that, as a composer, you try to find interesting ways to hook into a musical decision. Mm. And so this piano music that starts here is kind of a nod to sort of a Bach partita or probably fugato, where in Baroque music, in the style of Bach, the aesthetic is to treat all the voices equally, so that every voice that enters has a sort of equal importance playing the theme or the subject. And so that was kind of the very subtle nod to what the context being that the children are treated equally in the approach to food education. And so the music that comes out of it is kind of subtly nodding to that and treating the voices equally.
Right. Oh, that's very deep. And actually, I heard the elementary school students, 100% of them have now school lunch. And 93%, I think, for junior high school. So it's a good achievement. And kids are not suffering from poverty or everybody's eating good food. So I think that's great. Okay, so what do you think is the biggest message from the film to the audience?
Sure. Well, I think the biggest message is to help encourage us and remind us that a connection to our food exists and that it can help us to inspire and grow throughout our lives. And it is always developing, and it is always something that that we can kind of turn to at a point in our lives and say that, the more you understand food, the more you can have a stronger relationship with it, the more you can kind of understand so many other facets of our world around us and of our society.
Mm, right. And so the center, the head of this, the center of...
At the school lunch center. Right. Yeah, yeah.
He summarized. I don't know. I don't want to be, disclosing everything.
But well, he ends with a very, he ends the film with a very deep and I think truthful message.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't say what that is, but it's been one. It ties into I think what we've been talking about, that food does not. And I talked a little bit about this when I was here 2 years ago or a year ago, but food does not kind of materialize out of thin air. It is a product of so many people, and resources, and love that that you should remember that and be mindful of that.
Right. Yeah, well, that scene, I almost cried. So
mission accomplished then.
Yeah, it is such a big message that is summarized in his words. So listeners, you should definitely see it.
Well, I won't say what his words are, but I will say that when I was interviewing him, when we were talking, I was close to tears as well.
Mm.
And he said the words I wanted. He said basically what I had hoped that he would say, and that truly what I believe is the message of the film.
Mm.
So I won't, disclose too much what I think the message is, but you'll just have to see it sometime soon.
Come to the Museum of Food and Drink.
Yes,
right. We'll ask you where we can watch the film from now on. But before that, so what part of the Japanese food education program do you think would be useful in the U.S. and other countries, and how would you execute it?
Yeah. So I think when people see this film, they might think, oh, something like that might not be possible in my country, or something like that might not be possible in the United States. But number one, I would say there's already a lot of really great grassroots efforts that are going on here in the United States to help change our relationship with food, help to encourage healthier eating in the school classrooms and cafeterias. I think, you know, if it's possible at the school, I think one of the biggest changes would be the possibility of eating in a classroom. Taking kind of the cafeteria out of the picture and being able to bring the kind of reflection and style of teaching that exists in the classroom during lunchtime. This might not be possible because of infrastructure concerns or maybe in the cafeteria there's certain systems that are already planned out. But even just trying that maybe once a month or once a quarter or something like that, just changing the way children react with food and interact with food, I think is certainly one. And then just encouraging more of a relationship with nature and the outdoors. Mm-hmm. A lot of schools are already doing this through school gardens or classroom projects where they're growing pea shoots or something like that, but continuing to do that effort.
Right. I think so the Japanese system sounds very unique, but I think the fundamental principle is to educate kids to be responsible for their own body, make a decision, because like we said, food makes your body, and you are the one who can be only in charge until the last breath of your life. Right?
Yeah.
I think one of the things that impresses me about the Japanese outlook is that, you know, the lunch is almost seen like a class, like an educational opportunity unto itself. Whereas in America, even if the food is healthy, it's seen as more of a necessity. Well, we've got to get the kids in, get them fed, get them out. Mm. Where if you think about, as adults, so much of our lives, so much of what makes the world go around happens over a meal. Yeah. Relationships that are made from business relationships to romantic relationships. And so having lunch be almost like a class where how do we interact with each other? How do we interact with our food? Mm. I think it's just a little bit of a shift in outlook that would be really interesting to see happen in this country.
Mm. And I think on an emotional level, when you share a meal with someone, even if you know, they're just across the table and you're eating your meal, they're eating their meal at school lunch. Like, barriers break down and it's an opportunity to be able to interact with people or to reflect on your own self. And so I think, not only making healthy choices for you, but also just expanding your own perception of the world around you and your relationships with the everyday.
Right. So again, it's not only what you put in your mouth, it's everything about life. Right. Okay, so where can we watch Nourishing Japan?
So we have a couple of screenings coming up. We actually have our New York City public premiere this Thursday, February 20th, at the Museum of Food and Drink in Brooklyn. And I think there's still some tickets available. So,
and that's a very fun museum.
Yeah. And it's just a dream to be able to present the film there. And we're going to be in conversation. Myself, research assistant Yoriko Okamoto, and Susan Homaker of Japan Culture NYC, and then Jennifer Pomerantz, a NYU public health professor, will be providing open remarks to really contextualize what we'll be watching. So that's this Thursday. And then you can find all that information at nourishingjapan.com as well. It's cross-posted. And then there will also be a couple of other opportunities. April 16th at NYU. And that's not on the website yet, but check back soon. And then March 18th, Wednesday, if you happen to be a little further up the Hudson, we'll be doing a screening at the Culinary Institute of America.
Mm, Nice.
Yeah, looking forward to all of them.
Right. Yeah, I hope you can keep making it available, because I really want everybody to watch it.
Yeah, the goal right now, you know, we want to focus on, you know, private screenings so people can experience it as a group. I think there's a lot of power in people coming together mm-hmm. and experiencing this kind of screening. So, you know, if any listeners here are interested in hosting a screening, we would be delighted to talk about it further. Because really the goal is just to have as many people as possible see this film.
I really hope so. And any plans? Another movie? Film? Anything?
Well, first off, just, you know, screening Nourishing Japan as much as possible. I have a few other ideas tinkling around in the back of my head. But as far as, you know, plans for the future, short-term, showing this film to as many people, and long-term, I really want to serve or continue to serve as a bridge between the people who are doing this type of work in Japan, food education, and the United States or other countries in the world, to help serve as kind of an interlocutor and share ideas and practices that are going on between Japan and the world.
Mm, you're a very precious asset for that. So we're always here. So let me know when something happens. All right. So, and again, so the website, that's nourishingjapan.com?
Yes, nourishingjapan.com.
Great. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Yeah. Thank you.
So hopefully see you soon for the next movie.
Thank you.
So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for short topics or guests, please contact us at japanese@heritageradionetwork.org or kikuatema.com. Japanese is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Our engineer is Matt Patterson, and thank you for listening. I'll see you next week. Japanese is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a non-profit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thank you for listening.
Hey listeners, we're nearing the end of our 15th anniversary fundraising campaign, and we need your help to meet our goal. This campaign offers you a chance to win a unique food and music experience in one of the most exciting cities in America. Here's how it works. Donate to HRN and you'll be entered to win dinner for two and two tickets to a concert in one of eight amazing cities: New York, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, Nashville, Las Vegas, Charleston, Ardmore, Pennsylvania, and Asheville. All donations support our work educating food system storytellers. And when you donate, you can choose one of those cities and you'll be entered to win dinner and two tickets to a show. So help us reach our goal and enter to win dinner and a show in the city of your choice. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15. Thank you.